Okay, this is Dr. Phil Fernandez, President of the Institute of Biblical Defense. And today I have with me a guest, Nelson LaPlante. Nelson's a good friend of mine, and I'm going to be interviewing him. He's in the, I guess I would call you an economist. You teach economics at a few schools, and right now you're doing a little bit of teaching at UW, University of Washington.
Yeah, so I've taught at many, many schools in the area. Okay.
You used to teach at Olympic College when you first came out here.
Yeah, it's my first real job, temporary.
And so now you're teaching over there at University of Washington. I keep wanting to say UW, and it's going to go out all over the world. Some people might not know exactly what it is.
The Bonco campus. It's one of their smaller campuses, not the main campus, but University of Washington.
And now did you do your undergraduate degree in economics as well?
I did my undergrad in math.
Okay.
And I minored in economics and figured what the heck, I could maybe use it someday. And then I ended up doing graduate degrees in it.
Okay, so you got a Master of Arts from San Diego State.
It's my thickest jacket that I enjoy wearing.
You're also a runner, so you don't you don't like to weigh yourself down that much. Reason why I wanted to interview you're economic theory. You're a free enterprise guy, pro capitalism, and so I wanted to ask you a few questions on that. So first off, you can start out with what is free enterprise? What is capitalism? Are they synonymous? And then we'll be talking about why free enterprise? Why is that the way that we should go versus something like socialism or Keynesianism, things of that sort? So let's start out with that. What is free enterprise? What do we mean by that? What do we mean by capitalism? Are they synonymous? If they're different, where are they different?
Yeah, I think free enterprise is basically just allowing individuals to decide for themselves and use their own property as they wish. And you have minimal, laissez-faire, or let it be minimal government intervention.
Okay.
The terms of capitalism and stuff, I would think of them as being fairly synonymous, essentially.
Yeah. And there's kind of like perversions of capitalism, like crony capitalism, where it's really like what big businesses are, working hand in hand, money's changing hands with the government, so
kind of like corporate welfare or something like that.
Yeah, and where they kind of protect legislation to protect certain big businesses, and that's not really true capitalism. That's a perversion.
Yeah, I mean, big business doesn't really like free enterprise either. Yeah. Big business, typically, once you get to a point to where you're big enough. After all, I think it was Rockefeller who said competition is a sin.
Yeah.
And so nobody likes competition.
Yeah.
You can even think of it in your personal life. So I like kind of the individual behavior aspects of economics, human action.
Yeah.
And like you're dating somebody, you don't like competition, right?
No.
So how do you try to drive out the competition?
Yeah.
Well, there's many ways you can do it. And in big business, it
deodorant, with dating, deodorant, brushing your teeth.
Well, that's like a free market, right? You're trying to attract them, but competition could be, flashing weapons or something. Whenever a guy comes around, the person you're trying to attract to, you could think of it in terms of a business type of, not a business interaction, obviously, but a similar type of, nobody likes competition. Because, in the business world, competition means you're going to have to sell at a lower cost, you're going to have to provide better service, it's going to cost you more money, whereas if you could get the government to help you monopolize your enterprise, then you could really charge people a maximum. You can't charge them whatever you want, but you can charge them a much higher price to make a lot more profit.
That's what cracks me up about like Bernie Sanders, because he would slam big businesses and crony capitalism, and rightfully so. But then he acts like, therefore, we need to turn to the government for all the solutions, as if we should be more trusting of the government than we are of big businesses. Well, we can get trampled on by either one, and the government, they're the guys with the guns and stuff, so.
Yeah, like you mentioned deodorant, right? Yeah. Bernie Sanders' government should decide which deodorant we have, right?
Yeah.
Instead of having 18, and then I guess we could save the starving children, according to his ideology.
Yeah, that's like used to be. Of course, now they probably cost as much, but it used to be like in the 70s, blue jeans cost like something like $70 a pair in the Soviet Union when you could probably get them for about 10 bucks in the States, but there was like no competition. They were making chandeliers, but the ceilings weren't strong enough to hold some of them, so that they made chandeliers that couldn't even be held by the poor quality ceilings that they had.
Great. The Soviet Union is a great example of the lack of competition. They have what it was, the Edsel or whatever, the car. You know, you had a lot of choice on what kind of car you had. I think you had a red one, a white one, a black one, and a green one.
Yeah.
And they spewed out smoke. They had no shocks. They had no power steering. They were just pieces of junk.
Yeah.
And they could barely get you from A to B. But, you know, that's what the smartest guy in the room was able to develop. So,
and
central planning.
Yeah, nice.
Best.
So, and you know, I really believe God instituted human government to protect our freedom. So I think free enterprise would go hand in hand with that. You were kind of touching on it already, but basically, what's wrong with socialism? And what is socialism? And then what's wrong with it?
Well, yeah, so before I say that, I do think God instituted the idea among men of free enterprise. I mean, you know, socialists, they hate the idea of trade. So socialism is not sharing. It's not like being really happy and getting together and we're going to pool our resources. It's a lot, you know, people think Jesus was a communist because they shared. But no, socialism is force. I mean, that's really, you want to get down to the brass tacks. You say it's force. And at the point of a gun, it's the carrot and the stick, right? There is no carrot. There's just the stick to beat, and they beat you with it if you don't conform. And so socialism is the national ownership, the government ownership of the means of production.
Yeah. And now Karl Marx, he talked about one of the planks of the Communist Party is the abolition of private ownership. Yet, you know, communism is supposed to bring about the classless society. Well, that's never happened, and so you end up with a socialistic regime. He wants the dictatorship of the proletariat, dictatorship of the working class, is supposed to eventually, so you get this all-powerful socialist state, and then that's supposed to happen all over the world, and then eventually the dictators are going to give up their power and move towards socialism. So I kind of view communism and socialism, and communism is a pipe dream. I view communism and socialism as being synonymous.
Yeah, I think communism is more of the political elements of socialism, perhaps. And I can say with the idea, again, of, you mentioned the classless society, and I'm just going to preach some heresy here in this area that we're in, the Seattle area. And that is that, you know, income inequality is wonderful. Market-based income, market-based wealth inequality is an absolutely beautiful thing. Because do you really, you know, why do people go to school? Because they want to be better off than somebody that doesn't graduate third grade, right? I mean, why would you invest in yourself if you're going to have the same income as everybody else? So, yeah, I mean, market-based wealth inequality is wonderful. So they're talking about classes. Yeah, different classes are fine. There's nothing wrong with being rich if you did it in a market-based way. And again, that's trade. So socialism, I was going to say, they do not like trade. Socialists hate trade. They hate money because money involves trade. And any kind of trade, again, subjective value, is a basis of trade. Trade means, you know, we both trade, we both benefit, but maybe you benefit more than I do. Right? And that's not fair. And we can't have that. So we shouldn't allow trade. And why would you need trade anyways? The government provides it with all of your needs. Right? And so government provides it with housing and with food. Of course, you can watch some of the YouTube videos on Venezuela and see that it takes like 6 months before the government gets around providing you with that food.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you can survive 6 months without food, I guess, you'd be okay. And they provide you a little bit of food.
Now the redistribution of wealth take from the rich, give to the poor. Why doesn't that work?
Well, there's, on one hand, there's also the idea that if you were to allow them to go out and trade again, then within a number of maybe a decade or so, you'd be back to where you are. Because some people are just not good with money. We all have a friend who makes a lot of money, but he's always broke. Right? And you're like, how can he be broke? You make X amount of money, like two times what I make, and I have some of this in the bank, right? Yeah. And so some people are just, they have spending problems, not an income problem, it's like government, right? It's not an income problem, it's a spending problem. And so redistributing wealth, on the one hand, you know, if you allow them to continue in their ways, they're just going to blow it.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a total waste of resources. And two, is that you are disincentivizing. In fact, in his famous book, Piketty, a lot of liberals don't admit it, but Piketty says, I think on page 536 or something, he says the whole purpose of the wealth redistribution, the very, very high income tax bracket, is to eliminate those high income earners. So you really disincentivize any kind of capital accumulation and wealth building.
So it's kind of like taken from the producers and given to the non-producers, just encourages everybody to be non-productive.
Yeah, I mean, you see it in ancient times, it was taking from the people that produce food and giving to the people that consume food. And you know, people that produce food are like, why am I working? In Rome, they had price controls and things. It was basically a type of redistribution. They were giving one in three people in Rome were getting free bread and circuses from the Roman government. And so eventually you get to the point to where the people that are producing the food say it's not worth it because I can't, one, they couldn't sell it because of price controls. And so they just move into the city and they start consuming. And so really the idea of redistribution is to disincentivize any kind of production or wealth building. And you can't have a productive society without rich people, without wealthy individuals.
And why is that?
And that's because you need, poor people don't save very much. So if you have a high marginal propensity to consume, that is for every extra dollar you get, you spend most of it. You're not really saving a lot of money. And savings is key to wealth building because savings, money that you save, the rich, you know, there is no Scrooge McDuck, right? There's nobody that's got a money bin and they go swimming in it. It's like one of my favorite capitalists is Kevin O'Leary, and he always in the Shark Tank, he says he has his money, he wants to send them out into the world to have little money and come back, you know, with more. And so that's what wealthy do, is they invest. And it's this
and by doing that, it creates jobs and creates opportunities for others to move on up. So
yeah, it creates productivity, and I mean that's really what drives us, right? Is our ability to work, like it used to have to work from sun up to sundown, 7 days a week, but now we work 40 hours a week, right? And you know that's sun up to sundown in the wintertime up here, but it's only 5 days a week. And how do you do that without productivity? And productivity comes from capital accumulation. Right, I mean, you could think of, you go to Costco, just imagine a Costco without forklifts, right? So,
without what?
Forklifts.
Oh yeah,
Things that pick up big heavy, heavy pieces of equipment.
And so like raising, what would be wrong then, because it's kind of, it's a socialist idea, so what's wrong with like raising the minimum wage to try to help somebody?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of problems. One is you get into the idea of the mutually beneficial exchange, right? You have an employer and an employee, and they agree upon a wage. And you know, with a minimum wage, the employer kind of reluctantly agrees upon the wage. And yes, the employee perhaps might be better off with a $9 an hour than maybe he would be paid $7. But in a market based set, of course, you have competition, and you're going to drive that wage up. Some people think, oh, no minimum wage means they're going to earn $0 an hour. That's ridiculous. Nobody would work at that. So employers compete against each other for the best laborers. And so you really go against that mutually beneficial exchange, voluntary exchange, because you're forcing the employer to pay a certain amount. And then is that you force him to pay even more. The employer who, I like to say that originally you have an employer and employee working together, and they have a good relationship, and if the employer gives the employee a raise, the employee is grateful, typically. He's like, oh, you know, you really appreciate me. Thank you, the employer. He likes the employee, he appreciates him, and so he gives him the raise. And the employee therefore gets it. But then you get a third party to come in and really kind of breaks up this relationship and says, no, you must pay him in this area, it's $15 an hour in Seattle. And so I said, no, you must pay your employee $15 an hour. And the employer's like, I can't do that, you know, he might not even make $10 an hour himself. And now he's got to pay his employee $15, and his employee isn't going to the employer and say, oh, you know, you really appreciate me. So, oh, you wouldn't give me that money. It's just a big yada yada. And so it's the government. You only do it because you're forced to. So I think there's a lot of problems with
high minimum wage. At Liberty University, my economics professor, you know, asked, the great thing I learned from taking a course in economics at Liberty was that I did not want to be an economist. I wanted to pass that course and be done with it. But I do remember that he said that an increase in wages without an increase in productivity will almost always lead to inflation. And he was using the word inflation as inflation of prices. If your job is to produce 10 footballs a day for me, and I raise your wages, and you're still producing 10 footballs a day, as your boss, I'm probably not going to take that out of my paycheck. So what I'm probably going to do is jack up the price of the footballs now. And so I don't think, so in the end, you could actually end up in a situation where a guy who used to make $8 an hour, now you raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour, but there's a good chance that $10 an hour can only buy what is $8 an hour used to buy. Anyway, I even think that there's, sometimes it's almost, I don't know, class snobbery, maybe even racism, since so many minorities are involved with this. But
Walter Williams, right?
Yeah.
The great economist, black economist, and he talks about that a lot of minimum wage is based in racism, especially in South Africa under apartheid. And it's because they come from very crumb, you know, inner city, typically, and they're very poor schools.
It's like the assumption, and you know, you mentioned Walt Williams and economics professor, brilliant guy, just a great guy, but he takes it as an insult to African Americans for somebody to say, you know, you can't earn higher wages, you can't get a better job, so just leave it to us, we'll keep raising. That's not, when I was making, you know, $2 an hour mopping floors at Carvel, I knew I needed a better job. The worst thing that could have possibly happened to me was they kept raising the minimum wage. I'd probably still be there today, age 56, mopping floors at Carvel in New Jersey.
Yeah, no, that's another thing that I usually bring into it, is that it really should be insulting to the people that are making minimum wage. If you're making minimum wage in a restaurant or whatever you're doing, you know, this is not a job you're meant to do for the rest of your life.
And nowadays,
and basically, it's saying that look, you're useless. You're unimportant. You don't have any skills, and you could never be any better than a minimum wage job. So us from the government are going to come in with the white knights. We're going to save you from your own incompetence.
Yeah, and everything's been twisted around. So people say, no, you're a healthy, bright, young individual. You can just think smarter and work harder, and if you don't like the career you're in, get training in another field and just move on up the economic ladder. I would find it insulting for somebody to say, no, you can't do any better, so just stay where you're at, and we'll just keep raising the minimum wage.
Discomfort is not always a terrible thing, right? You don't want to provide somebody who, in this type of situation, minimum wage, you know, to be comfortable and fully satisfied in a minimum wage job is not healthy for you necessarily. And I'm not saying that it's great for them to struggle. I'm not saying that by any means. Let me preface. Right? But I'm saying that sometimes discomfort can get you to, you know, look around and say, you know what, I don't have what I want, right? So I don't have the things I want. How can I make myself better? And that's why, you know, it's an incentive for a lot of people to go to college, to go to school, to somehow better their skills and make it so that the market can provide them with a higher wage, not so that government can come force somebody to give them money. And, you know, what we've seen in Seattle is, prices, they say prices haven't gone up, but you've seen a lot of restaurants have restructured.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people in a minimum wage that are like a wait staff, you know, they're going to see their wages fall.
Yeah.
Because instead of tips, they're going to get, they're adding a 20% surcharge.
Yeah.
It's a minimum wage charge on restaurants. and some of that money goes to the back of the house, so maybe a dishwasher is better off, but, you know, a weight person who actually might be feeding kids, you know, that's not what you would consider a minimum wage job. It technically is, but no waiters, waitresses virtually make minimum wage. You're usually making two or three times minimum wage.
So
which mostly disappear under these.
First off, there's the assumption, the unproven assumption that the government leaders really love us and want what's best for us.
Or that they know what's best for us.
And then, number two, we assume that they know better how to spend people's money and how to help people succeed than the people who are voluntarily entering into these agreements to employ or work for somebody. Now a lot of complaints. I had an international student from China, and he was taught that capitalism is based on greed. It's greedy and it runs on greed. And how would you respond to that?
I recall Milton Friedman's interview with Donahue, where he asked Phil Donahue, "Where are you going to find these people that have no greed in the Soviet Union? You know, are there people in China? Are they not greedy somehow?"
Yeah.
No, I think one, greed is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's like, let me just mention Ayn Rand by my and her virtue of selfishness. Like, everybody is self-interested. And we can call it greed, and it's got a very bad connotation, but everybody is self-interested. Again, you can go back to, why do people want a higher minimum wage? Oh, so they can benefit society, right? No, they want a higher minimum wage because they want more things. And why do you go to college? You know, why do you invest in yourself? Why do you try to make yourself better off and get that higher minimum wage? Because you are self-interested. Everybody is. You can boil down everything people do to a rational self-interest.
Yeah.
And that's one of the fundamental aspects of human nature.
What I told this student too, I said, greed is part of the equation because we're fallen, we're greedy. Yeah. But I said, when everything's said and done, I think the key word that makes capitalism capitalism is not greed, it's competition. I said, when like you said earlier, when businesses compete for my money, I'm probably going to get a better product and at a lower cost to me than it would have been had not for it been for free enterprise.
It's great because everybody is, they're greedy, but if you get greedy people to compete with them each other, and they're all trying to sell their product at a profit, right, you have the greatest thing ever is the profit motive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that through that competition, if you just have one greedy person, then if you have one greedy person in power over everybody else, then that's what you will have if you have one person in power. And that's a problem. But when you get a bunch of greedy people and they compete with each other, then that's good for everybody else.
Now, can we be free without free enterprise? If we can't own our own businesses and determine, can we really be fully free if it's the government that's really, got us so bogged down that they've got all these regulations and taxes and rules and things and all, can we really be free if we're not free when it comes to the area of our own incomes, our own business decisions?
Yeah, but if you don't own anything, how can you be free at all, right? You only own yourself. There was a example, I heard in Planet Money, I think, and they were talking about a meeting in which the Chinese officials back in like the 70s or something, they were getting together and they were talking about, communal ownership of everything. And they're like, okay, who owns the little grain of wheat in the wheat head? So, that's owned by everybody, right? It's community. What about my teeth? Right? Who owns my molar? And I said, no. Do I own my molar? No. You don't own your molar. You don't even own your own teeth. It's communal ownership, right? So how could I move, right? If I don't own my own body, myself, if I have to ask you permission, can I lower my hand? Does everybody vote? Can I lower my hand, right? So I have to get this like communal voting system in which I do every action. So
it amazes me how many you'll have like Bernie Sanders supporters. And they want Bernie Sanders to move us towards a socialistic state because we're pretty much on that road already. If I just take their cell phone from them, if I'm teaching a kid, he's got a cell phone out, they act like, it's the end of the world and stuff. And So.
Yeah, no private property, but you need back my private property.
Yeah, and
so and people don't realize that property ownership is not just land and a big apartment building, right?
Yeah.
Private property ownership or private ownership of property means like this. This is my property. I can do with this what I wish, and I can exchange it with you. And go back to socialism means I can't trade because I don't own this, right? If I don't own anything, how can I do anything? How can I exchange?
Because I see pro-socialist, big government bumper stickers on BMWs from Bainbridge Island. I always thought they should have a bumper sticker that says redistribute the wealth, but get your hands off my BMW. You know, it just really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, when are we going to redistribute these? Because most socialists tend to be fairly well off, or they're just very ignorant of what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, you see a lot of very wealthy people like, well, usually socialism means, or wealth redistribution means, let's redistribute everybody else's wealth. Yeah. That's why you get all the Hollywood elitists that are, you know, DiCaprio being worth like $500 million, whatever he's worth, and he sails around the world in yachts and on airplanes, and then he talks about wealth redistribution and climate change.
Yeah. And all these. Robert De Niro bought quote unquote farmland, which nobody farms on there, and from doing that, he actually receives some kind of taxpayer stipends.
Or tax incentives.
So the wealthy socialists are always going to be able to hire lawyers to protect their little financial egg nest while they stick it to everybody else.
Yeah, like, I mean,
take from the rich, give to the poor. What that really means is take from the American middle class. And usually the money ends up in the hands of dictatorships all over the...
Yeah, everybody else is rich, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm not rich. I just have two BMWs, right? No, my neighbor, he's got three. That's rich. You should tax him. That's pretty much what everybody says.
Thanks, yeah.
Warren Buffett talks about the what we call the death tax, right? The inheritance tax, and he wants it to be, he'd probably like to be 100% or something, but he's not going to pay a penny of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because typically these rich people, they put it in trusts,
mm-hmm.
and they totally avoid the tax altogether. He's going to give it to the Gates Foundation, but he thinks that everybody else could be taxed at a very high rate.
I think it was Amazon.com that was fighting for the internet tax, and all I can figure is they can afford to take that hit, their competition can't.
Yeah,
so
they
just a helpful way to wipe out their competition.
Yeah, because originally they fought against it, but now Amazon has a business in pretty much every state,
mm-hmm.
if not every state, I'm sure they do. And the tax right now is if you have a business in Washington, or you have like a location, and your business is headquartered in Florida, you still have to pay the sales tax in Washington, which by the way is incredibly complicated. There's over 9,000 different counties and different tax rates in the U.S., and so, you know,
we might sell 2,000 books a year, and it turns out that Washington State wants me to, and no one is making any money on the Institute, so if I sell books in Silverdale, it's a slightly different tax rate than if I sell them in Bremerton, or if I sell them in Bellingham, and it's like, you know, it might be 9.632 and 1 and 9.647, and they want the exact, so I told earlier, or 8.6.
You probably have to send it to that.
Yeah, so I called them up and said, hey, I tell you what, I'll give you 9 cents on every dollar. You'll make out on this. And they said, no, you got to break it down. Well, it's like, well, guess what? I can't afford a full-time bookkeeper. So in the end, we just basically reach the point, talk to those who support the Institute, and we just basically give the books away for free, and if people want to give a donation, fine. And so the only time my books are really sold will be either at a bookstore or Amazon.com, and then I get a little royalty check. But there's an example. Things like that will keep somebody who heads a ministry like Institute of Biblical Defense, I have no incentive to work hard and think smart and get bigger so that I'll create jobs, because they already got me so overregulated that I don't even want to make enough money to pay my bills. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and so again, Amazon has big major computer databases that they pay enough tax in every little county that they can kind of know exactly where to send and all that. But if you, again, if you had like a, let's say you had an actual business and you were selling books, and somebody in Kansas County or whatever, in Kansas, they want to buy a book, and you have to, what do you have to do? Look up how much tax, where do I send my, and say it's $100, you know, I send my $9 check, or maybe it's a $5 check.
It used to be a little problem, only like at one time, like two states maybe, I think Massachusetts or somebody else, where if you sold something either online or through the mail, you still had to pay the state sales tax. All the other states said, no, that's none of our business. And, but whatever the case, these just, you know, if you're looking for formulas to destroy business and destroy productivity and destroy prosperity, socialism would be the way to do it.
Yeah, and Jefferson said the power to tax is the power to destroy. And so, yeah, if you can go and tax some specific industry that sells here, you know, somebody else sells in the area around it, you're going to destroy that one competitor.
Yeah. Okay, and let's see, I think you answered this throughout, how does capitalism help people? I think you mentioned numerous ways, so then what about the poor? You know, those who believe in free enterprise are often looked down upon, and say, well, you're against the welfare system, you're against helping the poor and stuff like that. What would your response be to that? How is capitalism good for the poor?
Well, capitalism means you're producing lots and lots of stuff. So you look at, where would you rather be poor, right? In a socialist, communist society? China? I've been to China a couple times, and I've seen poverty, right? You go around the U.S., come around here, the homeless, a lot of them do it by choice. Not everybody, obviously. But there are a lot of homeless and poor by choice. And it's like I like Kevin O'Leary again. He's got his, everybody's a self-made man. Some are more willing to admit it, right? And so there is a lot of that. There is a lot of people who are poor by no choice of their own, right? They have some kind of tragedy in their life or something. But again, capitalism means, and this kind of goes back to Marx, said that capitalism would never produce enough stuff. But now you go kind of the left that despise capitalism. It's all about consumerism. Capitalism makes so much stuff that you're just always buying things. And so the poor are always better off in capitalist societies because there is an abundance of things, goods and services that are made. And, you know, I can live off, very comfortably off, X amount of money. And if I make X plus Y, then I have an excess of Y. And as long as I'm not heavily taxed to Y plus something, then I can go out and I can be charitable. I mean, the most charitable society in the world, country in the world, is the United States. It's not even close, right? And that doesn't even include the taxes that are taken from us, right? The foreign aid, which is, as Juan Paulo said, is taking money from poor people in rich countries and giving it to rich people in poor countries.
Yeah.
This is the definition of foreign aid. But yeah, I mean, capitalism means that individuals are free to pursue what is best for themselves. And by doing so and engaging in trade and value added and things, that they make a lot of stuff, and they have a surplus, and they can provide that surplus to the poor.
I believe, too, that since the 1960s, when a lot of the welfare programs were instituted under President Johnson, since then, it's only really increased the percentage of the population that is in poverty. And so the welfare system can kind of chain you up in this vicious cycle of poverty for multiple generations.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of go and look at the graph. It's the institution, or the installments of welfare in America, and they'll say, look, you know, after welfare, the poverty rate went down, but then you go back and you blow up the graph, the poverty was way up here. And it came way down here under freedom, economic freedom, and then you install welfare, and it pretty much flattened out from there. We've never, I mean, it was, what, like 90%, 95% poor in the 1800s. You have the Industrial Revolution wiped out most of that, all the way up until the 1950s and 1960s, when suddenly it hit 20%, and it really pretty much flattened out because welfare disincentivizes. Yeah. Again, it goes back to minimum wage. It just disincentivizes productivity, and it disincentivizes work because let's say you are under the poverty line, you make something like $15,000, and you can go out and you can get benefits, well, because poverty does not include the benefits you receive. So you can get a housing stipend that's the equivalent of maybe $1,000 a month. That's $12,000 a year, plus you can get food, you can get, you know, if you have children, you can get WIC benefits, you can get all these benefits that may be worth $15,000 a year. You add, and but if you make more than, was it like $20,000 or something, suddenly you're making $19,999,
yeah,
plus your $20,000 in benefits is shy of $40,000, but then you make $20,000 and one,
yeah,
those $20,000 in benefits disappear,
yeah,
and you're back. So you make more by working less.
I know Ellen Craswell ran for governor, and she was a state senator for about 26 years or so, and was a good friend of mine, and it was really interesting. She was against the welfare state. She was for free enterprise. However, she actually fought to pass legislation, so if an unwed mother made, that was on welfare, got a job and started making some money, she fought so that that unwed mother would not lose her medical benefits, because an awful lot of ladies were refusing to get jobs and to start bettering themselves and to join the workforce. They weren't getting jobs because if they got a job, they would lose the medical benefits and they needed them for their kids. And so she was saying, well, if you're going to get them all caught up in the cycle of poverty through welfare, let's figure out a way to help them out of it. And so, but yeah, there's an awful lot of people. Malcolm X's mom was dating, his father died in a real questionable about whether or not it was an accident or murder, but he had like some about six or seven siblings, and the gentleman that was dating his mom just decided to leave town rather than marry her, because he knew, as a black, I believe he was in Chicago at the time, he wasn't capable of getting a job where he could support the family, and she was doing better with welfare than she would have done with him, so he kind of skipped town. Malcolm X's mom had a breakdown, was institutionalized, and so you know, there's an example of how socialism, where politicians can play it off as being a really nice thing, but in the end, you can enslave people in the cycle of poverty.
Yeah, you really trap people, yeah, because you disincentivize marriage, because a single mother can make a lot in benefits, and you know, I have a friend of my wife's who actually, so I won't get into that too much, but you're disincentivized to get from getting married, because if you are a single parent, you can get a lot of benefits, but as soon as you get married, you lose all those benefits.
Yeah.
And so people are incentivized to stay as a single mother, and if you want to be poor, be a single parent. Your likelihood of being poor as a single parent is well over 50%. I think of the people that are in poverty, I think it's like 53 or well over that are under the poverty line. And it's because it's difficult for a single parent to get out of poverty. How do you better your skills when you're working full time to support a child? You come home, you make dinner, you put them to bed, you bathe them, you do all that, and you know, these online university classes that kind of show that it's like you're up late, you're up till 1 o'clock in the morning, and then you got to get up at 5 to go to work. You know, it's just you don't have the kind of time in the day that it takes to better your skills if you're a single parent. So, Prager University videos, they say if you don't want to be poor, number one, graduate high school. Number two, get a job. Number three, get married, then have a kid. Now you don't have to get married and have a kid, but if you're going to have a kid, get married first. Then have the kid,
and then the chances of being poor is like almost non-existent.
Yeah, I think it's like 3% or less than 3% of the people under the poverty line are married parents.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Or have a job.
Yeah.
It's one of those two. But yeah, if you're a two-parent household, your probability of being under the poverty line is extremely low. And if you have a job, it's also very, very low.
And you can see another area where government interference really, and the welfare system really destroys family. If you visit prisons and you talk to the inmates, what a high percentage of them grew up without a father in the home. And And so, so it's very disruptive to the family.
Yeah, I usually look at, since the institutional welfare, how I think the out-of-wedlock children in the black community was low. I think it was in the 20s, and now it's in the 70s, and a lot of that is is government intervention, and, and it's a tragedy.
Yeah. And also, I would say, too, dealing with the poor, with the welfare system, like, if you need a dollar, if I give you a dollar, you get a dollar. If you need a dollar and the government takes a dollar from me, by the time it goes through the bureaucracy, you'll be lucky to get 5 or 10 cents. So, so it's not even cost effective.
I think J. Vernon McGee even said that. It's, you know, welfare is like taking blood out of your left arm, spilling 90% on the ground and putting it back in your right arm. So that's kind of the basis of how it
works. I can see J. Vernon McGee saying that. Okay, and so what about monopolies? Don't businesses need to be regulated?
You know, how does a monopoly start? I mean, there's a lot of monopolies out there that nobody complains about. You know, Google, right? Google's pretty much a monopoly. They would be considered a monopoly. Yeah. They have their own word, right?
Yeah.
Facebook is a pure monopoly. I mean, if you want to have an online friendship, I don't know who else there is. MySpace, I don't think they went bankrupt a few times. You know, locally, right, people don't really think of it in terms of a business monopoly, but we have any Seahawks fans here, right? The Seahawks are a monopoly. If you want to go watch professional football on Sunday or football on Sunday, it's the Seahawks. And, you know, I mean, if you really get into what a monopoly is, Russell Wilson's a monopoly, right? We've got a lot of people with his jersey walking around saying how much they love him. So if a monopoly comes from a market base, you know, they have their own, NFL has their own government protection.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, I mean, how do you monopolize a market? You provide the best service at the best price.
And so if you don't like that, then it's your job to start a business and compete with them and do a better job and sell a better product. So the private sector dealing with monopolies is a lot better. With the government, it becomes crony capitalism. I think it was Bill Gates and Microsoft was under congressional investigation or something about having a monopoly.
Back in the next
and all I can remember, he started, it seems to me, if I remember correctly, he started donating a lot of money to Catholic charities, which were really feeding hungry people, and they still wouldn't get off his back. So I told my wife, I said, this guy doesn't have a clue. But eventually he made some kind of huge multi-million dollar donation to the UN or something, and then all of a sudden you just didn't hear about it anymore. So I think he learned. He was, you know, new money, and you got to pay your dues, and what crony capitalism is all, it's not really about feeding the hungry.
It's always about control.
Yeah, and if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And now what about Keynesianism? There's so many people who call themselves capitalists, but it turns out they're really Keynesian. What exactly is Keynesianism?
So, John Maynard Keynes wrote a book called Modern Macro Theory, I think back in the 20s. And he was already popular, and, you know, he said to be a very brilliant guy, but his book was written with lots of errors and fallacies in it. Kind of the broken window fallacy type thing, which is, you know, if I pick up a chair and I throw it through a window, I'm going to create a bunch of jobs. But we've seen that's not... That doesn't work, right? War creates jobs. Yes, you know, there's very low unemployment during a big major World War II, but, you know, you're not producing anything. So, you know, I mean, we were much worse off in World War II than they were during the Great Depression. You know, you had a lack of medical supplies. I guess my grandmother's first husband, I think, I had no idea, but apparently he slipped on at a skating rink, and he got an infection, and because all of the antibiotics went off to Europe, he died, right? So you could die of very simple things during war. But a real Keynesian would say, well, you know, war, it blows a lot of things up, and you have to rebuild them, and it takes people to do that, and that means employment, and therefore, you know, we're stimulating the economy that way.
So it's kind of like a Keynesian would say, we are not full-blown socialists. We don't want the government to control everything. At the same time, you do need an intellectual elite aspect of the government to kind of monkey with the economy, because if you just leave the economy to itself, it's going to be
total chaos, right?
Yeah, nobody wants that.
To get the animal spirits, right? People stop spending, you get that demand curve, kind of the aggregate demand falls off. Some kind of aggregate demand, some of the demand in the economy falls back, and you get below your natural level of unemployment. How do you stimulate that back to your long-run aggregate supply curve? So you have that kind of natural unemployment rate of 2 to 4%. Well, government should come in and pick up the slack. Where the private sector falls off, you could have government come in with projects, right, coming and building roads and bridges, right, shovel-ready projects, which is a comical term, but yeah, and build things and kind of pick up that aggregate demand, the slack. But what it does is it creates a lot of malinvestment. So government comes in and starts spending money, and there's a lot of issues of where does the money come from? Does the U.S. government have cash just sitting around? You know, no, right? They're $20 trillion in debt, so where are they going to get the money? They're going to borrow, which means taxes in the future, which means, yeah, so... I mean, we had some stimulus plans. They had the tax rebates in 2008, I think it was, and everybody got a $600 check or a $300 check. And what we found is that there was no consumption dip. There was no change in consumption of individuals. It's because if you get a check in the mail and times are tough, like, you know, I don't know if I'm going to have a job next week, I should probably save this. I'm not going to spend it. But the idea is that you give money to people that the middle and lower class, and they have a high marginal propensity to consume. You have a Keynesian multiplier. You know, you're not going into any of the details, but they'll go out and spend $100 million. They'll go spend it. It'll cycle through the economy. And it'll create $400 million or a billion.
You still have, like, the puppet masters controlling the economy.
You still have a lot of central planning.
Thinking that they're going to make better choices at the free market. So.
Yeah, you can get the monetary policy as well, with lowering interest rates and incentivizing people to go borrow. But then you get into the Austrian business cycle, and where economic downturns come from is recessions come from that artificial interest rate policy and cheap money, and it creates a lot of malinvestment, they call it. You look up the skyscraper theory, it's really interesting.
Well, and what is the skyscraper theory?
So somebody, and I forget the name of the paper, they went back into even back to the 1800s, and they looked at recessions. And they found that corresponding with every recession, either right before the recession started or during the recession, they had just completed the world's tallest building, or one of them. So you go back to the 1928, 29, 30, I think there were a bunch of tall buildings.
Empire State Building.
1911, we had a big recession. They had a tallest building built. 1920 or 21, there was one. You go back to 2008. You know, Dubai, right? The tallest building in the world, the biggest condo. They had to stop building because of the world economic crisis, and right now they're building the world's tallest building. They're trying to, you know, beat that again. And I think it's in Shanghai or Dubai. I forget which one, but yeah.
Is there an actual cause and effect relationship there?
So the idea is that you get this big roaring 20s, roaring housing market or something. It's driven by cheap, easy money, low interest, and so people go out and they find, oh, money is abundant. It's a miscalculation of entrepreneurs. They think, oh, there's a lot of demand going on, therefore I should go invest in housing, right? And it's not that there's
a bubble.
Yeah, it's not that there's big demand. It's that it's from the cheap, easy money that the Fed is printing, and that's getting out into the market, and people borrowing at very low interest rates. And as soon as those interest rates start to rise, and you saw this, you know, people have these arms, and 3 years later, they're adjustable rate goes from 3 to 5% or something, and their monthly payment goes from a quarter or a third of their monthly salary to half, or, you know, 60% of the salary. Nobody can afford that.
You mentioned the Federal Reserve. Can you explain what that is? Are these elected officials? Who are they, and what do they do?
So, the Federal Reserve is a private institution. It's founded it was created in 1913. There's a whole creature from Jekyll Island that, you know, goes into the founding of the Fed. It's privately founded, privately run. But it does have a very tiny, close relationship with the government. It's not a government bank, per se, but the head of the Fed is appointed by the government. You know, Janet Yellen right now is appointed by President Obama. And Bernanke was appointed by George W. Bush, and Alan Greenspan, which I think was under Reagan. And so, yeah, they appoint these people, but it is a private institution, and they are allowed to, you know, essentially do what they want for the most part. But they print the money, they control the prime interest rates, the Fed funds rate, which is the interbank rate, the discount rate, which is the rate you borrow from the bank at. And so, yeah, they control, basically they control interest rates. And so they really control the economy with those interest rates. I mean, the QE 1, 2, 3, 4 was all Fed policy.
Is the Federal Reserve, is that constitutional?
Well, there's, no, it says that only the U.S. government is supposed to coin money. Now they say, oh, well, you know, the Fed doesn't coin money, it prints money. There's a difference there, right? And so, to say no, that the government was supposed to define money as, you know, so many grains of silver, so many grains of gold, the bimetal standard. But the Fed, yeah, the Fed got away from that. It's a fiat money. We haven't been on a gold standard since 71. That was a quasi-gold standard. But
What's so bad about being off the gold standard? What's the big problem with, like, paper money and versus, like, silver and gold or even paper money that's backed by real silver or gold?
Well, if you have paper money backed by real silver and gold, you know, like a gold or silver standard, then that wouldn't be so bad, because as you had in the 70s, up to 71, when you could take a $20 bill and you could go down to a Federal Reserve Bank and get an ounce of gold for it, or you could take, you know, gold, what, actually, the dollars were 90% silver until 64, and so you could actually get real money. But once you get off of the idea of having a certain amount of gold for every dollar you print, then you have nothing for every dollar you print. You can just print as much money as you want.
So the paper money has no real value.
No, it's got no value at all, right?
Yeah. And so it's
just whatever you, what will you give me for
so it? So it's a basis, it's all based on what the government says it's worth, or our trust in the government, or whatever.
It's a relative value. It's a floating exchange rate with all the other currencies of the world. And so with paper money has never lasted very long in history. I mean, you have paper money invented in China millennia ago.
Okay, if it doesn't last, what does it lead to? Well, how does it usually end?
It usually leads to hyperinflation and a destruction of the currency altogether. Now, we've only had paper money since 71. And we've seen our greatest inflation rates in the 70s, and I know they say officially inflation is pretty low right now, but yeah, paper money the problem with paper money is you can print as much as you want, and there's no restriction.
It becomes worth less and less and less. And now, mass inflation might mean that for a loaf of bread it might cost $20. Hyperinflation, there's no limit. It could cost $20,000, where the money is just, they stop printing all the lower bills because it's worthless.
Can you go to some of those Zimbabwe $100 trillion notes, and even Venezuela, where Venezuela had a contract to print their currency with, I think, a Canadian or a company in Michigan or some in the U.S. or whatever it was, and they canceled their contract with Venezuela because they didn't think, they're printing Venezuelan currency. But they didn't want the contract because they didn't think Venezuela could pay them, could actually pay them the money it cost to print the currency. So that's how bad it was. So they're printing the currency, but they didn't think Venezuela would be able to have the money to pay them to print their own currency.
Germany,
they took like $200 to $300.
When the Nazis came to power, there was the hyperinflation and the Weimar Republic.
Yeah, and you can even go back to, they had a hyperinflationary scenario in France, fiat money inflation in France, when you had, what happened was, the revolution, they took over the church lands, and they didn't have any money, and they didn't have any way to get money in the government. So, hey, let's print money, and it's, you know, more complicated to use cash, but they would pay an interest on it. And they said, hey, we'll have the church lands, they'll back the money. And people said, no, it'll be inflationary. So, no. So they print money, it creates a little boom. But at the end, the boom is short-lived, and once the money's spent, prices go up. They said, hey, let's do it again. So they printed it, a shorter boom, prices go up again. And in the end of 5 years later, prices were upwards of 50 to 100 times what they were before the boom. And you actually, because people stopped, in that case, people stopped taking paper money. They said, no, I want actual money. And so the government had to do a fiat, which they had to say, a legal tender law, right, which is if you don't accept this paper currency, then you will you lose your head, right? And the person that turns you in gets half of your possessions,
so what happens? To own gold at one time in America?
In the U.S. between 33 and 74.
So FDR made it illegal to own gold, and it's kind of like...
I would say in the France example, just like in the German example, what you had is you had the guy who came in and saved France, and his name is Napoleon, right? So, you know, good times, right?
Yeah.
And of course, in the Weimar Republic, you had the guy on the white knight comes in, he saves the economy, and happily ever after.
Yeah. So it's government takes over, creates the big mess, and then whatever fills that void, maybe something.
Yeah, well, the issue is people. When people are so bad off, in the case of the Weimar Republic, is people were so broke, bringing wheelbarrows full of cash to pay things. I mean, they're pretty money one-sided, right? They're running out of ink and paper and everything. And it got so bad that they said, "Look, we don't really care who you are. Just please save us."
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things that might be the way the world is going, that they're kind of pushing it in that direction. So even the UN, you know, the League of Nations create a big world war. And at the end of the war, you say, hey, there's one way to prevent a second world war, which is create a League of Nations. That didn't work. So one way to create and prevent a third world war would be the United Nations, and we'll all get together, and we'll all be the socialist society.
I think that's the direction we're heading, is to the economic collapse of the United States of America. When you get back to Germany, there was always that joke about the guy that goes to the store with a wheelbarrow full of money and then goes inside, looks in, comes out, and his money's on the ground. Yeah. And he stole the wheelbarrow because it was worth more. But, all right, well, we're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to bring in...
I would say, again, you know, China, when they started instituting the idea of private property and a little bit towards free enterprise, they're not free enterprise system, they're still...
But they're moving in the right direction.
They eliminated their number of people that were in abject poverty, which is defined as $1.25 a day or less. They reduced that number by 96%. Going from a socialist, communist system to kind of opening up their markets.
And it seems to me they didn't do that because of the goodness of their heart. They just needed to be more pragmatic, look for something.
Yeah, they had Tiananmen Square, right? Yeah. See, Tiananmen Square, and they said, we want political and economic freedom. And kind of what they said, I guess, is, well, we're not going to give you political freedom because people are greedy and they love power.
Yeah.
So we'll give you economic freedom.
Yeah.
And yeah, so they opened up and yeah, I mean, you see, especially in the last 10 years, you've seen a massive influx of students from China.
Yeah.
And it's not because they're poor. Like, you have money to come study in the U.S.
Yeah, their parents are either members of the Communist Party or their businesses that are favored by the communists in power, favored by the government. But I always tell my Chinese students that I say, at least you guys are moving in the right direction. We're moving in the wrong direction. If there's enough time, we're going to be like two ships passing in the night. But let's take a little break, and then we'll bring Blake into this, Blake Kilborn, and we'll try to have a spirited discussion on fascism and free enterprise.